From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the re-release of The Graduate. It's been 30 years since an alienated college graduate, played by Dustin Hoffman, was seduced by his parents' friend, Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft. We'll talk with screenwriter Buck Henry about the making of this touchstone film. It was one of the first films about the generation gap of the 60s. It also launched Dustin Hoffman's film career and generated the Simon and Garfunkel hit Mrs. Robinson. Also today, The Power of Names. We talk with Justin Kaplan and Anne Bernays, who have written a new book about what we call ourselves and what it means. By the way, the two are married to each other, but Anne took back her maiden name when she began her writing career. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bob Whitten. Security officials have decided to add metal detectors at the Empire State Building in an effort to prevent a repeat of yesterday's shootings. A 69-year-old Palestinian opened fire on the observation deck, which is visited by hundreds of thousands of people annually. From New York, NPR's Melissa Block reports it appears to be a random act.
Ali Abu Kamal, whose passport indicates he was from Ramallah in the West Bank, entered the United States this past Christmas Eve. A receipt found on his body shows he bought a .380 Beretta semi-automatic handgun in Florida late in January. And just after 5 p.m. yesterday, he used that gun to deadly effect on the Empire State Building's 86th-floor observation deck, which was crowded with tourists. A 27-year-old musician from Denmark was shot and killed. Six others were wounded, several of whom remain in critical condition. The gunman then shot himself in the head. Appearing on NBC's Today Show, New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said so far it appears the gunman has no connection to a terrorist group, no other incident after that, no threat before. Abu Kamal's widow says her husband was not politically motivated but was in financial distress after being cheated out of his life savings. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
In a day of ceremony far more elaborate than he asked for, China's Deng Xiaoping has been cremated. From Beijing, NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports thousands lined the route for today's procession.
The procession to the Babaoshan Cemetery was slow and somber, slow enough that the crowds lining the mile-and-a-half-long route could get a glimpse of the white van carrying the man who transformed China into a free market power. Deng's body was cremated at the cemetery. His ashes will be present at tomorrow's funeral, which will be broadcast live on national television. Although 10,000 people are invited to the ceremony in the Great Hall of the People, police will be on high alert outside in Tiananmen Square to prevent the possibility of demonstrations. In the midst of this final day of funeral preparations, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright arrived in China for the last leg of her nine-nation tour. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
Former President George Bush, speaking in Washington today, says China is not going to fall apart as a result of the death of Deng Xiaoping. Bush is a former ambassador to China and also predicts China will allow freedoms to continue in Hong Kong after the British turn over control in July. The Supreme Court today decided not to review an Arkansas dispute over identifying political candidates as opponents of term limits for Congress. It let stand a lower court ruling outlawing the practice. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages up 44.25 at 6975.87. Trading is moderate, 198 million shares. This is NPR News. Wall Street trading moderately today, up over 44 points. The Nasdaq Composite up nearly 3 points. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has more.
The market is being boosted by merger and acquisition news. In the day's biggest deal, American Electric Power is joining force with Public Service Company of Colorado to buy Britain's Yorkshire Electricity for nearly $2.5 billion. At the same time, Jefferson Pilot is acquiring Chubb Corporation's life insurance unit. Today's advance is being led by drug stocks, along with tobacco and computer software issues. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Supreme Court today did agree to examine a dispute over who may join federally chartered credit unions. Federal credit unions offer many of the same services as banks, but can charge less because they don't pay federal taxes. Credit unions are supposed to serve people with a common bond, that is, the same employer, the same union, or living in the same neighborhood. But since 1982, they have allowed some small businesses, too small to form their own credit union, to join existing credit unions. Banks have challenged that expansion, and a federal appeals court upheld that challenge last year. Burma is protesting the European Community's opposition to its joining ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Its deputy prime minister says Burma is a friendly country. The European Community maintains that Burma has suppressed democracy and human rights. Thousands of angry Hungarian farmers pulled their tractors and plows across roads today to protest new taxes. One protester said it is very difficult to make a living from farming now, and the government is making it almost impossible. I'm Bob Whitten, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherie Gross.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
It's been 30 years since that depressing advice was offered in the film The Graduate. An anniversary re-release is playing at the Film Forum in Manhattan and at the Castro in San Francisco and will soon open in other cities around the country. We're going to hear about the making of The Graduate from the screenwriter Buck Henry, who adapted it from the novel of the same name. The Graduate was one of the first films to depict the alienation young people felt from their parents' generation in the 60s. And the audience was hungry for it. The Graduate had the biggest box office of the year and the second biggest of the decade. It was the film that made Dustin Hoffman a star. He played Benjamin Braddock, a college grad who's returned to his parents' upper-middle-class suburban home. He's lost. He has no idea what to do with his life, although he knows his future is not in plastics. One night after a party thrown by his parents in his honor, he's recruited to drive home Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft, convinces a reluctant Benjamin to come into the house. She puts on some mood music and gives him a drink.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Yeah, well, he guessed right, and she succeeds. But after they've started their affair, he falls in love with Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine, played by Catherine Ross. The mortified Mrs. Robinson tries to marry her daughter off to someone else, and she succeeds. But right after the I do's, Benjamin breaks into the church and runs off with Elaine. In the last scene, Benjamin and Elaine make their getaway on a bus. But after several moments of triumph and exhilaration, they're staring blankly into space. The screenwriter Buck Henry also co-wrote the TV spy spoof Get Smart, wrote the screenplays for Candy, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and has been a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. We spoke at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of The Graduate. Well, let's start with the end of the film. The end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop, and this, like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer, I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole... It looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, I don't think we did test market it. But also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame. He's so odd looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous, you've got to
No, nobody ever said that. And also, it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl, and they've run away from the people that they're scared of, and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
Did you know what was your guess?
No, I didn't know.
Okay. Because the movie's so open-ended, it leaves itself really open to a sequel, which you actually pitched in the movie The Player. And we actually have that scene here, the beginning of Robert Altman's movie The Player, set in Hollywood. And at the beginning of the movie, you know, throughout the movie, everybody's making their pitches to the big producer, played by Tim Robbins. Here's Buck Henry as himself in The Player.
Okay, here it is. The Graduate, Part 2.
Oh, good.
Now listen, The three principals are still with us. Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, Catherine Ross. Mm-hmm. 25 years later, and so are the characters. Ben, Elaine, and Mrs. Robinson. Ben and Elaine are married. Still, they live in a big old spooky house up in Northern California somewhere. And Mrs. Robinson lives with them.
Mm.
Her aging mother, who's had a stroke.
Mrs. Robinson has a stroke,
so she can't talk.
It's going to be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
With
dark
a stroke?
And weird and funny and with a stroke.
Okay.
Maybe it's not a stroke. Maybe it's, I don't know what
anyway,
it is.
Go on.
It's a malady of some sort.
Okay.
She's up there in the bedroom upstairs listening to everything that happens. They've got a daughter who's just graduated
from college. That's good. Young blood.
22, 23-year-old, like a Julia Roberts.
Right. Excuse me.
Yes. What did you let me do with these scripts?
That goes to Bonnie Chereau.
Okay.
And find out from studio security how Adam Simon got on the lot. I want to know.
Adam Simon? Okay.
Okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Julia Roberts comes
home. Julia Roberts
their daughter, home. The graduate.
Yes,
and she's
the new graduate.
The new graduate.
Or the postgraduate.
Okay, Griffin loved it. He just wanted me to run it by you.
Thank you.
So did you ever try pitching that one for real?
That was my real pitch. no, I thought it was, obviously I meant it to be a kind of parody of what people really do in studios. But that didn't stop after the opening night screening of the player. It didn't stop a producer at a studio from stopping me in the outside by the popcorn and saying, you know, that was really amusing. But nevertheless, don't you think we can do something with that? It seems very practical somehow with the actors all being alive. I had to admit that's true. It is practical. It's hell to use dead actors. So It's been pitched a number of times over the years.
Did you pitch it to studios, or did they pitch it to you?
No, I've never. I think it's a totally crazy idea.
So you've turned down all requests.
Yeah.
What are some of the crazier pitches you've got?
For this?
Yeah.
They always say, you know, just carry on with the story, like
whatever that means.
Yeah, it's easy to do. So I thought we did about, I think it was 8 or 10 takes of the player, and each time the pitch changed a little since it was all being improvised, and it got loonier and loonier. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel became characters at one point.
We'll continue our conversation with Buck Henry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview recorded at the Film Forum in Manhattan with Buck Henry, who wrote the screenplay for The Graduate, which has just been re-released. When the film came out in late 1967, it really tapped into something. There weren't really many films at all that were addressing this generational split, that were addressing the alienation that college people felt when they went home back to their parents' houses and they knew they didn't fit there anymore, and they didn't want to be there anymore, and their parents' friends were kind of scary. To them. So this tapped into that at a time when Hollywood was always like several beats behind what was really happening in the world, and TV was even more beats behind that. What do you remember of what people were saying about what The Graduate meant, you know, to our culture when it was released? And what rang true to you, and what did you think was really, like, absurd?
That's a lot of questions in one. You know, it's odd because we didn't think of it as defining a time or a place and went about making it assiduously avoiding the errata of contemporary politics. And the only vague mention is when the guy who has the rooming house says, "Are you an outside agitator?" Which was more about Berkeley than it was about the time. And actually a critic, when the movie was released, took us to task for saying nothing about Vietnam, which I thought was really stupid, because it's simply not what it's about. It does come from a sensibility of some years before the time it was made, although I think the sensibility is universal. The sense of alienation that people have between teenagedom and 20-something years old, when they feel most hostile, a lot of people do, most hostile to their environment, to their parents, to their schools, to all that stuff. And since we all came out of the same time and the same sensibility, that is, Charles Webb, who wrote the book, Mike Nichols, Larry Terman, and I all got out of school, got out of college in the 50s, we all related to the same sources of that displeasure or enemy or whatever you want to call it.
To me, one of the greatest paradoxes of the movie is that it's about, you know, a young man who comes home and he's just so lost in his parents' environment. And so what does he do? He has an affair with his parents' mother. You know, it's the first film that really addresses the culture, you know, the generation gap. And so he's sleeping with somebody of the other generation. It's really paradoxical.
Always a good idea. To pass the time and to get to know new friends.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me. Now,
well, they're two very
mother,
different things, sleeping, you know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right,
loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
Uncomfortable segue, but yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh yeah.
So the movie was adapted from a 1963 novel. Whose idea was it to make it into a movie?
I think Larry Terman read the book and fell in love with it and brought it to Nichols. And they were then turned down by all five major studios. That I believe is the way it happened, which is how it ultimately came to Joe Levine. And it's odd when you think of it, because here's Nichols coming hot off Virginia Woolf. But I think they all thought it was too edgy and too racy and too questionable and didn't quite get what it was. There was no script. It was just the book. And then Mike said to me one day, read this and see what you think.
Now, you were the second or third screenwriter
to
have a go
at it? I was the third or fourth, as far as I know.
And all the previous adaptations were thrown out.
Right.
So what did they do wrong?
Well, I don't really know, because I didn't read them until after Calder Willingham sued for credit.
Sued you for co-credit?
Sued, yeah.
Sued you personally or sued the film company?
No, not sued. What's the word? Arbitrated, quite right, thank you. The other writers didn't. And I only read Willingham's script once, so I really don't know what he did wrong.
It's a diplomatic thing to say, too.
Now, well, I was surprised that he sued, because he's a really good writer, and he didn't need to.
Right, right. Now, tell me if I'm right about this. I don't know where I got this from, that the Charles Webb, the novelist, after the publication, went to live and work in a nudist colony? Did I make this up?
No, you didn't make it up, although you might have. It's even more complicated than that. Charles Webb, who is in a sense Benjamin Braddock, no surprise, he wrote the book, he wrote it out of his own experience, married this girl and sort of ran off from Eastern, I can't remember where he was brought up. It either was Pasadena or it wasn't. Whichever it was, they left it behind and they went on a kind of mystical journey where they've been for the last 30 years. I'm in constant contact with him. Although I haven't seen him in 30 years, I've spoken to him many times and we've corresponded. And about 10 years ago, he and his wife, who has changed her name to Fred, called me or wrote me from a nudist colony on the coast, on the California coast somewhere, and asked me if I would want to come down and be the best man or witness at their remarriage. And I'll probably always regret the fact that I turned it down, but I couldn't envision myself standing with a lot of naked people on the beach witnessing a marriage between Chuck and Fred. And they're wonderful, one might say somewhat eccentric people.
The most famous line in The Graduate is the line where one of the father's friends says, "I've just got one word for you, one word, plastics." That line struck a chord. I mean, it seemed to just kind of sum up everything that was false, that people didn't want their lives, their futures to be part of.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. It doesn't, you wonder why it took me more than 10 seconds, if indeed it did. I worried about plastics for a while and even talked to Mike about, are we too old-fashioned with plastics, which was sort of a 50s, 60s way of complaining about society's falseness. But I couldn't ever think of anything that was as interesting or more interesting, and or anything that wasn't a better word for them to say. Plastics is such a nice word. And the guy was so good who did it. The best thing about that was a few years later, I was watching television and I saw the scene come up, the party scene, except the actor didn't quite look like Dustin and the actress sitting in the living room didn't quite look like Anne, but it was every shot all the way through plastics to the end of that piece and then same photography, and then why not try the Peace Corps? And the Peace Corps had done an ad perfectly parodying the movie. I wish I had it. It was really a good piece of work.
Did you like it and respect it, or did you feel...
Oh, I thought it was terrific, yeah.
What year was this?
Beats me.
Back in the 60s, or...?
I think the 60s, yeah, I think, or maybe the early 70s.
Buck Henry, recorded at the Film Forum in Manhattan, which is now showing The Graduate. It's been re-released in honor of its 30th anniversary. It opens soon in other cities. We'll hear more from Buck Henry in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, more about The Graduate with screenwriter Buck Henry. Also, names, how they affect our own sense of identity and the way we see other people. We talk with Justin Kaplan and Anne Bernays about their new book about names. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Buck Henry about the making of The Graduate. He wrote the screenplay. The film has been re-released to commemorate its 30th anniversary. I spoke with Buck Henry at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of The Graduate. You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. Ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
Wait, now, I understand you asked Doris Day.
I didn't ask anybody, God knows.
Well, she was approached.
But I think Larry and Mike asked Doris Day. I'm not sure. I think they did.
What about Ronald Reagan?
I don't know whether it ever got to him. And think how his life could have been made more meaningful.
That's right. Think how much different the country might have been.
There were a number of people. I know at one point Mike was thinking about Jeanne Moreau, which I think would have been wrong, although she would have been wonderful.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was... It's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. It was so interesting. So then we rationalized it. Because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long, we had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same... Suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller, and this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's wonderful.
And nobody ever... there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah. And
now the funny thing is, like I read, she was in her 30s, I think about 36 when making the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, although he's playing 20 years old, was really 29. So that would mean their ages are, what, 7 or 8 years apart, which, I mean, lots of people have relationships with people 7 or 8 years apart.
But you have to buy him as being 21.
As being younger, right. But did they have to do anything to make him look younger and her look older so that they'd seem far apart, even though they weren't really?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, Dustin... Well, all male actors play younger than they are, inevitably. And I think Dustin is buyable as being 21. I was amazed when I found out he was 30. I had had some experience of Dustin in the theater. He worked in a theater I was playing in the early 60s, and then in the mid-60s, I went to this performance of a Ronald Rabe play called Harry Noonan Knight, a really strange and interesting play in which Dustin played, in which I saw this guy, I didn't recognize him, playing one of the three lead parts. He was playing a crippled German transvestite. And I, by the middle of the first act, I knew I was seeing a really weird theatrical thing because I realized that the producer had gone out and hired a crippled German transvestite to play this part. The accent was perfect. The limp was spectacular. And his transvestitism was completely convincing. So I'd seen Dustin do really amazing, at least one amazing piece of work, but I didn't know until I saw him do the test that he could do this too.
Now, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot I listened to it a bit while working. He thought, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
You'd think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and you know, there was never anything that could replace it, finally. I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker, and you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called, the Strawberries? Lemonhead, yeah, well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
So what do you think of lines like Cuckoo, Cuckoo, Mrs. Robinson? Did you feel that enhanced the meaning you were trying to bring out?
I think Paul had a kind of off night when he did Cuckoo to her. Because he's generally very, very clever with lyrics, and I think maybe, I don't know.
I'm going to squeeze a little question into the couple of seconds we have remaining, which is, did you identify, aside from admiring some of your mother's friends, did you identify with the Benjamin Braddock character at all?
Totally.
You did?
Oh, yeah. And so did Mike and so did Larry. We all did. I think that's what drove them toward the book and me subsequently, too.
What was it in your life when you were, say, in your 20s and out of college?
I was totally Ben Braddock. Uh-huh. I mean, when Mike and I started talking about this at the beginning, we were, you know, spent days laughing about our own ineffectual early 20s demeanor. You know, if we could, we'd sleep all day. If we, we'd do anything to avoid any of the embarrassment of contacts with people we didn't know, family, all the sort of unspeakable acts that go on between members of the same generation. And also it's not only about not knowing really what you want to do or not having a passion to do something, but it's the fear of not being, of the passion not working out, and the sort of stupidities you hear about other people, and then the other people are your own friends and family, and that's so appalling you don't know what to do with it. This isn't a universal attribute, thank God, but it is something that happens in every generation with people of a certain age.
If you identified with Dustin Hoffman's character, that kind of adrift, I don't have a future, I don't know what my future is, what was the turning point for you where you found writing, you found theater and movies?
Well, I always knew I wanted to do it. It was just a question of people not letting me. So when I was younger, I got out of the Army and I spent years, like 7 or 8 years, sort of batting around. I'd go on tour with a show. I'd write things that nobody would buy. And I did all that stuff that actors do. And then finally I started working in television and it all became a clearer path. I was never, I'm very lucky. I've never been out of work since I started working. But the number of years before that were very edgy.
Are you excited to have the re-release of The Graduate? Is that something you're pleased about?
Oh, I think it's swell. I hope people enjoy it. I hope it doesn't seem like we're battering them with it since something happened 5 years ago with it. And I mean, maybe it's a perennial. But I think it's pretty good, and so it's okay that it's there.
Buck Henry, thank you so much for coming. It's wonderful for you to be here.
Thank you, Terry.
Buck Henry wrote the screenplay for The Graduate. We spoke at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of the film. It's been re-released in honor of its 30th anniversary. Here's a scene featuring Buck Henry in the role of a hotel clerk as Dustin Hoffman begins his affair with Mrs. Robinson.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
Where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
The Graduate is playing in New York and San Francisco and opens March 14th at the Royal in Los Angeles. It opens soon in other cities. Our thanks to Bruce Goldstein and Steve Grenio and the staff of the Film Forum. Our recording engineer was Joyce Lieberman. Our interview was produced by Naomi Person. Coming up, the power of names and why our names seem to have so much power in defining who we are. This is Fresh Air. Names have a special power over us, our sense of identity. Sometimes that's a negative power and people are compelled to change their names. Sometimes the name of a loved one has magic and is recited over and over like a prayer. Novelist Anne Bernays and her husband, the biographer Justin Kaplan, have collaborated on a new book called The Language of Names. One of the chapters in their book is about married names. Anne was Anne Kaplan after they were married, and she took back her maiden name, Bernays, after she started writing.
When I got married, and that we're talking about the Middle Ages now, the goal, the end goal of every girl's life was marriage. I mean, it seemed as if life stopped there. That was it. You grew up in order to get married and have children. And I was no different from anybody else born in 1930. So when I got married, I was just so pleased to be Mrs. Kaplan. And then I started thinking, now, maybe I think I want to write something. Maybe I want to write some stories. Maybe I want to write a novel. And I published a first short story under the name Ann Kaplan. And then I decided, I'm not Ann Kaplan. I'm Ann Bernays. Ann Bernays is the person who was named when she was 2 days old, let's say, or maybe even before that. And suddenly to become a totally different identity, that is Ann Kaplan, it just seemed wrong. Now, the funny part of it is that when we got married in 1954, it was just before the feminist movement, and a lot of marriages of people my age didn't survive through the feminist revolution, that is, of women feeling that they needed a very clear and stronger self-identity. And mine did survive. And maybe it's because I had gone back to my own name long before most people who got divorced. And I just decided I was Ann Bernays. And I think it gave me a kind of, it was like finding my sea legs in a way.
Justin Kaplan, how did you feel when your wife Ann reassumed her original name when she started writing? Did you take it personally? Were you offended?
Well, I suppose at first I was a little taken aback, as I think anyone at that period would have been. You begin to wonder, is there something wrong with me that I'm being rejected in favor of her maiden name? But after a little while, it began to make total sense to me, especially since it seemed silly to have two writers in the same family with the same name. We're different people, and I respected the difference, and I'm all in favor of it now.
So, Ann Bernays, when do you use the name Ann Kaplan?
When I go to the dentist.
when you're paying a bill?
When I'm paying a bill, all my paychecks come to Ann Kaplan because the Social Security Administration will not issue me a check under Ann Bernays, even though I've published 8 novels under that name and 2 nonfiction books and teach under that name. I cannot get, unless I go to court and have it legally changed back, I can't get my name, my real name, on a check.
Different religions and different ethnic groups have different approaches to naming children. You've done a lot of research for your book. Justin Kaplan, what are some of the things you learned about different traditions used for naming children?
Well, we did a fair amount of digging in anthropology and so-called primitive societies as well as American society. The range of practice is absolutely enormous. In some societies, the child's name is considered to be is an incantation, a sort of a magic formula, not to be shared with outsiders. In other societies, such as ours, infant naming is a public rite of passage, and the style is altogether different. Let's say between the white community and the black community, the white community tends to be fairly conservative and unimaginative in choosing names for children. If you look at the family of the novelist Henry James, you'll see that for 3 or 4 generations, the Jameses were named either Henry or William, which is terribly confusing. We've noticed very conspicuously that in the black community, there's a huge amount of imagination, invention, and variety. We found we were a printout of children's names from one zip code area in Chicago, and the number of unique names was very impressive. But by unique names, I mean a name that occurs only once, that was truly original, that may not have ever been heard before.
In some traditions, children are named as a way of paying tribute to the living. In other traditions, children are named as a way of paying tribute to the dead. What did you learn about that?
tribute to the living, you can do it unless you're an Ashkenazi Jew. As a matter of fact, and there's one tradition which goes back a couple of centuries, it's called a gift name. And I think it started right after the slaves were freed. And that is that if somebody gave you something or did something for you or supported you or took you in or was kind in some extended way, you named your child after that person as a so-called gift name. And that really is lovely. If you're an Ashkenazi Jew, you cannot name your child after someone who is still alive, because it's bad. It's going to it may come back and haunt you, or it's bad luck.
Well, it's bad for a perfectly rational reason. The fear is that if a child is named after an older person and the older person dies, the angel of death may call at the wrong house.
And then there's also the tradition of good Catholic families of having to give their child the middle name of one saint. So that's why you see so many Catholic children or people who have recognizable saints' names. It's part of the ritual.
My guests are novelist Anne Bernays and biographer Justin Kaplan. They've collaborated on a new book called The Language of Names. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Anne Bernays and biographer Justin Kaplan, their new book, The Language of Names, examines how people are named and why names have so much power. Justin Kaplan, you wrote a biography of Mark Twain, whose real name was Samuel Clemens. Why did he change his name?
Well, but part of it had to do with the convention in the 19th century of humorists and entertainers taking pseudonyms. But in the case of Mark Twain, the change of name from the choice of the name Mark Twain was deeply organic and is part of his evolution from a sort of drifter journalist into someone who said that his vocation was to excite the laughter of God's creatures. And at the point at which Mark Twain decides that he's going to be a humorist and a writer is the point at which he discovers his new name and signs a travel letter to a Nevada paper. I feel as if I'd just awakened from a long sleep, and he signs it, "Yours dreamily, Mark Twain." And I think that's the first time that the name Mark Twain appeared in print. I was also fascinated by somewhat the same process with Walt Whitman, who started off as Walter Whitman Jr., and then when he discovers the personality and identity that he wanted to project in Leaves of Grass, he becomes the simple Walt.
Yeah, and I should mention you wrote a biography of Walt Whitman as well. And Anne Bernays, what turned you toward writing this book? What inspired you to do it?
Well, one of the things was my mother, who belonged to something called the Lucy Stone League, where women were determined to persuade other women to keep their names after marriage. At that point, I was very young and thought, what's the big deal here? And I realized later, much later, what the big deal was. So I had that, her kind of pioneering work in the names trade to think about. But also as a novelist, I was fascinated by how a fiction writer names his or her characters, how you know when it's right, how you know when it's wrong. You do, and you may not be able to articulate why you know it's wrong, but you have to go back and change it throughout the whole book. When you name a character, it's much more important than when you name a child, or it's much more complex, let's say, because when you name a child, what you're doing is sticking on that child, what you think you want that child to become. When you're naming a character, you have to get all the little currents, the cross currents, the undertones, the overtones, all the odor that rises off the name. And a name is a message to your readers. So I was fascinated by not only how fiction writers name their characters, but also where they get these names from. For instance, the novelist William Gaddis claims that he gets his names for characters off the name tags on the toll booth collectors. Well, that's all very well, but he's not going to name a character something he got off at the last tag he saw unless it somehow fits the character. And the biographer of Arthur Conan Doyle says that when Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes novels, knew he had it right was when it had a certain sound to it, a ring, or like a key going into the door and clicking in the right way. And it's a wonderful sort of complicated emotional process that you go through.
You've both taught university level. Do you like your students to call you by your last name, by your first name? Do they call you professor?
Well, here we differ on this. Annie prefers the first name basis with her students. I still think that it's somewhat important for students to realize that there's a difference between the faculty and the student body. And I think that difference ought to be commemorated in the way people are addressed.
And I'm always embarrassed when my students come up and say, "Hi, Professor Bernays." I sort of look over my shoulder for somebody else. It doesn't sit right with me. But we do differ on this.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Anne Bernays and Justin Kaplan have a new book called The Language of Names. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Maria, Maria, Maria. I've just met a girl named Maria. And suddenly that name will never be the same to me. Maria. I've just kissed a girl named Maria.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.